Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture.
One of the basic ideas that's central to Immanuel Kant's duty-based or deontological ethics is what we call the categorical imperative. Now, a categorical imperative is sort of at the root of Kant's moral theory. It tells us what we ought to do. It gives us a clear understanding, in his view, of what our duties are and what our duties to not do certain things are as well. So there's certain things that are duties that we ought to be doing, and like we said in previous videos, we ought to be doing them for the sake of duty because they're the right thing. And if that's the case, then there's other things we ought not to be doing. So for instance, if we have a duty to tell the truth, we have a duty not to lie. Or to lie, in another way of putting it, goes contrary or against duty. Lying is immoral precisely because telling the truth is morally required. The categorical imperative helps us figure out what in fact our duties are. And this is very important because when we talk about duty-based ethics, a lot of people have the general view that, well, we just have duties and they're out there and we know what they are, and people tell us, hey, you have a duty to do this as a son or daughter, and you have a duty to do this as a student or professor, you have a duty to do this as a citizen. But the question that's left unanswered is, well, why precisely do I have those duties? How do I know that that's actually what I'm supposed to do? So the categorical imperative is supposed to answer that question. Now, in Kant's view, our duties that we have as individual human beings, as individual rational beings, are duties that everybody has. So they're not really role-specific the way they are in some other deontological views. They're not coming to us as well from above or from outside, somebody imposing them on us and saying, you have a duty to do this. These are things that we ought to be able to discover by the application of our faculty of reason. And that's what the categorical imperative has us do. So let's look now at this first formulation. It reads like this. Act only on that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it should be a universal law. So what does that mean? Well, there's several parts to that, and I want to go through each of those in turn, in part because students will often have some misunderstandings about these or confusions. You notice I've also put on the board, what is Kant not saying? Because there are certain wrong directions that students will take this. I've seen it happen in papers, on tests, and conversations in class. Certain ways in which this gets misread that come up over and over and over again. So I want to try to address those. So let's start first with what he is saying. Act only on that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it should be a universal law. So what is this telling you? This is telling you that in general, you should act only on maxims. You should only do things. You should only engage in actions. You should only intend to do things. You should only will to do things. Maxim, remember, is a way of describing what it is that you intend to do, or want to do, or are choosing to do, or are doing. You should only act on maxims that fit the rest of this criteria, right? So that's saying that if you're going to be a moral being, you should only do certain things and you shouldn't do other things. Certainly shouldn't do things that go against what this is going to provide you. What do we have? Through which you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. The next really important conception here is this idea of becoming a universal law. This is often called the universalization or the universalizability principle, that if something is moral, if you're going to say that somebody should do it, it's the right thing to do, everybody should do it. You're saying if person A should do it, person B should do it, and anybody else who comes along who happens to be a person ought to do it as well. So, for instance, if lying is the wrong thing to do, it's not just wrong for me, it's wrong for everybody. If telling the truth is the right thing to do, as Kant does believe is the case, then it's the right thing not only for me to do, but for you to do, and anybody else who would come along they ought to do it as well. That's what it means for it to be a universalizable norm. Kant is saying you have to imagine, you have to use your capacities as a human being to think about how or whether this thing that you want to do, that you're wondering, is this okay for me? Is this the right thing to do? Is this the wrong thing to do? Let's say we said everybody's going to do that. It's going to become a universal law, and not a law like, you know, the policeman comes along and says, oh, you know, if you don't do this, you're going to go to court, we're going to haul you in. Rather, a law of nature, meaning that everybody would do this. So you have to carry out kind of a thought experiment. If you want to say that everybody should tell the truth, now imagine everybody telling the truth in every circumstance. And that would become the way in which human beings behave. That would be the kind of universe that you're going to live in. Some things Kant thinks, if you think about them, they can't really work out like that. What do we mean by this? This is kind of hard to wrap your head around. Kant thinks that there's a logical, not necessarily impossibility on its face, but an impossibility or a contradiction as you think it through, as you work it out. So let's say we take lying and telling the truth, right? You say, is it okay for me to lie? Well, what would happen then if everybody lied? If the maxim is, well, whenever it's convenient for me, I'll tell a lie, then anybody, whenever they're in a situation where it's convenient to them, they shall tell a lie. That would be the universalization of that maxim. Kant seems to think that if you try to imagine a world like that, sooner or later you're going to like run into like a mental brick wall, because you're going to realize, you know, if that was the case, then the whole idea of lying and truth would break down. And there wouldn't be any difference between the two, or they'd become indistinguishable, or there'd be no meaning to the act of lying, let alone to truth. So that means that couldn't work. There would be a contradiction there of some sort. Now, there are some things that Kant thinks that you could imagine to be universalized. Certain maxims, certain choices, certain actions, the way that we could describe them, that you could imagine to apply universally. You could say, well, everybody will act like that. Everybody can act like that. But you wouldn't be able at the same time to will that to be the case. So why couldn't you will that to be the case? Here's a place where Kant admittedly starts to get a little bit, maybe not entirely consistent. See, here's the thing. Kant says that consequences don't matter. Duty-based ethics is not based on the idea that it's going to pay off if we all behave this way, the way, you know, so utilitarian ethics does, or other forms of consequentialism, contractarian ethics, those sorts of things. Instead, he says, this is something that you can sort of figure out by using reason alone. But whether you could will that or not would really depend, whether you could will your maxim becoming a universal law, if it can in fact become a universal law, you can't imagine a world in which that would be the case. Can you will that world? That really depends on whether it makes sense for you to want yourself to be in that kind of world. And it's a little bit difficult, admittedly, to see why you would want or not want to be in a certain kind of world, depending on what kind of world it was, depending on the effects that would be produced by making that kind of a policy across the board, so to speak. Kant doesn't think that this is really falling into that. In his view, what we're doing is we're just, you know, engaging in practical reason without any empirical admixture of consequences or effects or that sort of thing affecting our motives. And again, I realize that this is a little bit hard to swallow, but here's the way that Kant more or less sees it. This is conceivable, but there are some things that you can't will it, because if you were to will that, your will would be, in a certain way, inconsistent. You would be willing things that go against what is either in your interest or what you ought to be, something that would involve some sort of process of development. When we look at the examples, you'll see that this is more or less the way he talks about it. So I understand that this is a little bit tricky, but what I do want to say here is, look, we've got three main parts to this. Act only on that maxim. So this is specifying. We're looking at general types of behavior that we can describe, and we're saying only those are going to be moral, which we can say would become a universal law of nature. So everybody would be doing them. And you can also will them to be a universal law of nature. So there's no inconsistency in your willing. There's no inconsistency in the idea of that kind of behavior or choice universalized itself. So you're looking for inconsistencies. Inconsistencies in the kind of world that you're imagining. Inconsistencies in willing that kind of world for you as a person. Now, that's what Kant is actually saying. Let's talk now about what he's not saying, because, again, this is where I see students get mixed up a lot. And, you know, when my students do this, I point this out to them, but perhaps if you're a student in somebody else's class, they might, you know, come down hard on you and say you've totally misunderstood Kant and not give you a second chance or something like that. So Kant is not saying, this is the first mistake I see people making. Kant's not saying that everybody does follow these laws. As a matter of fact, he knows that most of the time people don't follow these laws. He tells you that in the groundwork. He says, you know, we tend to make exceptions for ourselves. So he's not asserting that if you want to say that telling the truth is a duty, that you're actually asserting because of this categorical imperative that everybody tells the truth. That would be crazy. Kant actually thinks, no, it's totally the opposite. It's because of the fact that a lot of people don't actually tell the truth in this world that we actually have to really push ourselves to tell the truth. So he's not saying that everybody does follow that law. He's also not saying that you couldn't empirically, that is, in the kind of being that you actually are, you couldn't have a conflicted will in a certain sense in carrying this out. So you, for instance, have a hard time keeping your hands off of other people's stuff because you like to steal other people's stuff. You can still, at the same time, will that it be a universal law that everybody should respect each other's property, and you will that to be the case. You just would like it also not to be the case because you'd like to steal other people's stuff, and you realize that that's a problem for you, right? Do you see the difference there? In that case, you have a bifurcated will. Your inclinations are drawing you one way, but reason is telling you, hey, this is something that can be universalized. You know, we ought not to steal from people. I want to think that of a universal world, a universal condition in which nobody steals, everybody respects everybody else's property, and I actually will that. You can have a will that's empirically sort of going in two different directions, and then you choose to favor this direction. As a matter of fact, Kant says, that's when you can tell that a person really is acting out of duty, when they have to go against their inclinations. Now, the third thing, Kant doesn't say that this would necessarily produce good effects. That's not where the impetus of Kantian deontological moral theory lies. It's not about producing good effects, good consequences. I understand that when you look at this, it kind of looks like I'm imagining a world and seeing how it would turn out for myself. But Kant thinks what you're really imagining, what you're really thinking about, is whether there is an inconsistency in this, in cognizing this and in thinking about this, or whether there's an inconsistency in willing that same thing. The last thing, if you can't universalize it, is it immoral? In the case of some things, if you can't universalize it, this would make it immoral. So if you're only acting on maxims that you can actually will to be a universal law, when it comes to what we call strict duties, then it's telling you, look, you have to do this, and if you don't do this, you're doing the wrong thing. You're acting immorally by not doing that. You're acting morally by doing the right thing. There are some things that are called non-strict duties, meritorious duties, and they're not duties in quite the same sense. Instead, those duties, they tell you what you ought to do, but if you don't do them, you're not actually like necessarily doing something immoral, you're just not acting morally. So there's a fundamental difference between the two of those.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.